We are back post All-Star edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Also our first 15 and 60 for a while. We're going to do the Western Conference, but first some news, a rather newsworthy All-Star weekend. What's up, Danny?
Doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. We're coming to you live from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico at my dad's place. Internet here may be spotty. We apologize in advance for the audio quality. Maybe we should do that for every episode, actually. But in any event, let's get started here. The first piece of news that came out today, Zach Lowe wrote a great column kind of previewing the trade deadline. And one of the biggest nuggets he had is that teams now are using $92 million rather than the official league estimate of $89 million as their projection for the cap. So I think we should probably start using that as well.
Right. And that really matters because not only does it affect the way maximum salaries work, but it also affects certain teams on the margins. You can think about the Golden State Warriors, who I've written about their possibilities. Just adding a little bit changes things. And there is also the possibility that it goes up even higher than that. And that's something that we've seen in prior years as well.
That's right. And Tim Bontemps reported that some teams are projecting that at least it could be as high as $95 million, maybe not that it will be. And that all makes sense because the way the mechanism is if teams don't spend enough money in the prior year, that amount then gets built into the new cap. And that's why the cap was $70 million this year instead of more in like the high 60s, because teams didn't spend that much last year. And now we're finding that to be the same thing again this year. And that's because when teams use cap room, they're going to be much closer to the cap with their eventual salaries. Or you have teams even like Portland or Philly who aren't really, you know, are below the floor and aren't even going to pay out up to the cap themselves. Even if they do trade for nominal money, their actual payout will be a lot lower. So when the players aren't getting enough of their percentage of BRI, which when teams use cap space, that turns out to be the case, then you end up with sort of an artificial increase that is not necessarily tied to the revenue in the cap the next year. And then when you see that huge spike again in the projections to 108 the year after that, that's because, again, with the cap going up so much, the projection is teams won't be able to spend enough to get the players their percentage of BRI, and so it's going to bump up again. Now, maybe that mechanism doesn't work that well if this is what keeps happening, but sort of the framers, as it were, didn't really anticipate that the cap was ever going to jump as high as it has with this TV money. So it seems that the silly season is going to continue for at least the next couple of years here.
You brought up the 2017 point, which is what I was going to go to with the idea that that's why it's going to spike again. Well, part of the reason. And instead of what I'll talk about is that Tom Ziller, I think I give him credit because he's the first person I saw do it, talk about the idea of why they should have the audit done by the start of the moratorium, because the possibility of it jumping a couple million could be a game changer for a few teams. And there isn't really a good reason for it because there isn't much revenue being generated in the last week of the league year.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think quite a few have made that, and it's worth considering. Also, another thing to kind of keep in mind here as we go into the trade deadline, the offseason, the planning that teams are going to have to do is that probably silly season is going to last through 2017, but then we are likely to see, I think, a retrenchment in 2018 and beyond, whether it's the cap not going up that much, whether it's not going up as much as just the annual raises on some of these contracts, which can go up to 7.5% when you're re-signing your own free agent. And so if I were a team, just in general, especially a team that is not typically considered a marquee destination, what I would be trying to do is engineer it so that I had space in 2018, 2019, especially if you're kind of more of an up-and-coming team, maybe the Jazz, the Magic, those type of teams. Maybe you can find that final piece in 2018, 2019 when there's not going to be nearly as much competition as there is these next couple of years.
And that's especially true when teams like the Lakers will probably be targeting 16 and 17, that they'll have thinned themselves out of the market because they'll be getting a lot of these guys anyway.
Yeah, maybe that's true. And then also teams like the Lakers and Knicks, where you have some motivation then to not use up all your 2018, 2019 space now if you're not getting those absolute number one guys. I think that's what I would be trying to do, is maintain flexibility, maybe overpay for guys, but on shorter term deals, and then try to roll those contracts over and really maybe get some more bang for your buck in the latter part of this decade. But that's getting a little bit far afield, a little bit more news before we get into the 15 and 60. Zach's column also reported that sources close to Al Horford are saying that the ability to get that fifth year, which is very smart on his contract for re-signing with the same team, whether it's the Hawks or whether he's traded now, is going to be paramount to him, and rightfully so, because that he's not going to get the same amount at age 34, 35 that he would on the fifth year of a contract he's signing when he's 30. And so that makes a lot of sense, but it also means that he probably is going to be seeking something that's close to the maximum 4 or 5 years.
Exactly. And you can think about it in the idea of surplus value. You know, the reason that you're getting somebody like Al Horford, and I think this logic applies to Dwight Howard as well, is you hope that you're getting surplus value for them in the first couple of years, because that's when they're better, and that's actually when they're cheaper, assuming a traditional contract structure. So if you're him, you want to lock in that money for that last year if you don't think you're going to get that as a free agent. And I think we both agree that that's unlikely.
Yeah, Howard is an even more extreme case of that, because he'll be eligible for the 35% max. And now, just to kind of update the figures too, if it is $92 million instead of $89 million, now you're looking at that 10-plus-year max for Howard starts at $30.3 million. That 7 to 9 year max, which is going to be Durant, Al Horford, Mike Conley, basically almost exactly at $26 million, just a little bit under. And then the 0 to 6 year max for guys like Andre Drummond, Brad Beal, that's going to be $21.7 million. So those have all kind of bumped up really by a few hundred thousand as a result of the cap potentially being higher. We don't know for sure that that's the case, but it meshes with what I was thinking was probably going to happen anyway. So I will probably be using that $92 million figure from now on until we hear differently. What else we got?
Well, we're still waiting on definitive news, but there's concern that what happened to Chris Bosh, why he missed the All-Star game with calf injuries, could be something more serious. Of course, considering blood clots made him miss the rest of the second half of last season, that has been floated as a possibility, but we don't know anything yet. Of course, best wishes to Chris Bosh, one of the league's best players, and from every experience I've had with him, a really legit good guy.
Yeah, and Chris, last year, it was believed that calf injuries, blood clots in his calf, were responsible for the eventual migration to his lungs. They've caught it earlier at this point, but he's going to be meeting with doctors on Thursday now per Woj. And the Miami Herald also had some good reporting on this. I think it was Barry Jackson, that to see whether his blood thinners are going to allow him to play again this season. But you have to imagine at the very least that he's going to miss some time, and that is going to be so fatal for the Heat, because he's their one guy who provides any spacing for that team at all, even if it's only with 2-point jumpers. I think they could go into a major, major tailspin if he's going to miss time. So, and also just something that seems like it could again be potentially career threatening for Bosh, and also, you know, something that is very serious and that we hate to see.
And on a smaller, of course, less important than his health note, the Heat pick is top 10 protected again. There's a possibility that that comes into play.
Wow, that's amazing. That would be amazing if that actually happened. On the more sad news, MKG, we talked about his shoulder injury that he had. There was some talk that he might try and rehab it. That, in fact, is not going to happen. He's going to have another surgery on, again, a torn labrum in his right shoulder, so he's done for the year.
Disappointing, especially considering how well they played with him. And with Charlotte's uncertainty, you have this kind of question about will we ever really get to see them at full strength? But here's hoping we do.
Yeah, I really felt like this team, with him around, could have been the fourth best team in the East. I think that I really like a lot of what they had been doing. But yeah, it's really unfortunate that we're never going to see that. I think without him, their chance of getting their defense to quite a high enough level to really get into that conversation is low, but they still have pretty good playoff odds for right now. But yeah, speaking of playoff odds, let's get to the Western Conference. And what we're going to do, a little bit different order here, we'll go through in order of best to worst projected record. Longtime listeners know we like to consult 538's projections and also ESPN's BPI, by both of those compiled by former NBA consultants Neil Payne for 538 and Ben Alomar for ESPN. And let's start now. We'll go in the order by BPI with the Golden State Warriors. The Warriors are projected at 73-9 by 538 to set the record, and 72-10 by BPI.
So they're 48-4. They're 14-2 since the last time we did this. They have an, according to, I believe it's 538, they have an 89% chance of getting the best seed in the West, which is actually really important because one of the kind of dynamics, if you're thinking about the Warriors, there are kind of two regular season things. One is to get the number one seed, and the second is potentially to set the wins record. And the clearer the first one of those gets, I would say and to some degree the dicier the second one gets. But at the same point, this is a team that is beating teams and getting to rest their starters in the fourth quarter, so they might not have to make those choices.
Yeah, we might as well just turn this into an addition, yet another edition of Crazy Warriors stats. So let's just list some of these off here. In the first three quarters of games, this is per our buddies at Nylon Calculus, 16.4 net rating, and overall it's 12.4. So a lot of that is just bad garbage time. A lot of it, too, is that Steph Curry typically sits the first 4 to 6 minutes of the fourth quarter. But I think it also is kind of more indicative of how good they are than that overall net rating because they have just thrown out some terrible garbage time lineups.
And then, and part of what you can tell the difference between that and garbage time lineups is that in clutch situations, that's 5 points or less in the last 5 minutes, they are an eye-popping plus 39.3. And they're 16-1 in those games. So this, when
yeah,
they actually,
that's the typical under five, like 5 points or under with under 5 minutes to go. That's the clutch situation right. Definition there. Yeah.
So when they have to play those guys, they're doing incredibly well.
Yeah. And then they can trot out the death lineup with Green at center. Oh, yeah. The one was definitely the Nuggets, where Steph had the turnover after they had that furious rally at the end. All right. A little bit more Warriors crazy stats. Versus teams over 500, they are 19-1 with a 13.7 net rating. They actually have a better net rating versus teams over 500 than teams under 500. They're only 12.3 net rating against those teams. If you were looking in games at teams over 500, the next best is the Spurs with 9.0. So they're 4.7 better than the Spurs. And then OKC with 4.8 is the third best versus teams over 500. So the narrative that the Warriors really get up for playing other good teams is definitely true. I mean, some of those blowouts that they had, that amazing streak against the Bulls, Cavs, and Spurs plays into that as well. But there's more evidence here that Golden State turns it up against good teams. And just that performance, 13.7 net rating against teams over 500, would be the best ever over a full season in 20 games. Just absolutely remarkable.
And that also lends credence to the idea that they could go after the wins record, because if you can get those wins, then you that builds a buffer that, you know, you're going to win most of the games against inferior teams. Maybe you'll blow some of them sometimes. But if you can win those games, it's kind of the reverse of the calculus you use a lot of times, which is win all the games you should win and then, you know, pick off some of the better teams. The Warriors kind of do the reverse.
Yeah. Okay. So then, of course, we get to the San Antonio Spurs also having an all-time great season at 45-8, 15-2 since we last checked in on them.
So they have, they only have an 11% chance of top seed. So they're the only other team. You know, it's 89-11. And
yeah, that's per 538.
Per 538, and 538 gives them a 1-4 chance of winning the championship. How does that feel to you?
It feels probably about right, I think, and because you have to imagine if they get to the finals, they're going to win. So I would give them, you know, a 1-3, 1-4 chance of beating the Warriors. But that might even be too high, especially since they are very likely to have. BPI, interestingly, also projects them at 67-15, but gives them a 40.1% chance at the title. So I think 538 likes the Warriors a little bit better than BPI does. And that would be pretty remarkable. I think that seems to in the Warriors, giving them that chance, considering that Golden State's going to have home court.
Yeah, and one thing that I found interesting with them, kind of one of the quirks of doing this a little while after we were going to do this 15-60, is that I had put in a note about checking the Spurs in clutch situations, because early in the season, they weren't doing super well. But since Christmas, which just happened to be the timestamp I looked at, they're the best in the league. So that's something that they turned around. They're plus 35.4, but they've only had 19 minutes of clutch time in the last month and a half. So you have to take that with a lot of salt.
Yeah, a lot of that is in that Magic game that we chronicled, I think, in our last episode before the break, where they came back from, I think, you know, 10 down with 5 minutes to go. That one, just one game like that will really help out your net rating in those situations.
Yeah.
Note here that's apropos, given that we're talking about the Spurs, there's an 83% chance, according to 538, that a West team wins the finals. And that's between the Warriors 50%, Spurs 25%, 5% Thunder, and then like 2%, 3%, Clippers. So,
I think that's
pretty depressing for East teams. I think that's low.
Yeah. And I'm somebody who said the Cavs were the most likely champion, but I mean, I'm sitting here thinking I think I would have all three of those West teams favored over the Cavs.
I think I would too, although I think the Cavs match up reasonably well against Oklahoma City and San Antonio. I think they're just not quite, you know, they match up extremely poorly against the Warriors like many do, but I would actually give them, you know, a 40% chance maybe of beating Oklahoma City and like a 35% chance against the Spurs. But, obviously rampant speculation there. Who's next? Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City Thunder. Yeah. One of the things that stuck out to me, well, first of all, let's say the record 40-14, 16-3 since the last time we did this. 16-3 is a really, really good record. It is also the third best record for a West team since our last 15-60. So I think that's this season in a nutshell for them.
Yeah. And they're playing very well. I think that although there is some angst about some of the things that Billy Donovan has done, I am willing to consider him now at this point an upgrade over Scott Brooks, at least. I think their offense is a little bit better than it was, and I was impressed by what they were able to do defensively against the Warriors. I think they just tried a few more outside of the box things, like putting KD on Draymond Green, that Scott Brooks, really quite the traditionalist, you know, when you consider how long he started Kendrick Perkins and how he would start every game with the Ben Wallace Memorial post up for Kendrick Perkins. Donovan really seems to have moved beyond some of those little crutches, even if they're not playing beautiful basketball yet by any means. I think that he has shown a little bit more forward thinking of an approach. One interesting thing though, they are only projected to be 57-25 by 538. So that'd be only 17-11 for the rest of the season, which, and they do have a pretty hard schedule. They got two games less against San Antonio, three against the Spurs, and they got to play Cleveland, two against the Clippers, one against Toronto. So they do have a pretty hard schedule. I think they're still going to beat that 17-11 though. I think they're going to get pretty close to 60 wins, if not actually getting there.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's true that the Clippers probably won't really be pushing them from behind, but they have kind of a tough schedule, but they're really good and they're playing incredibly well right now.
Quick question. Percent chance that they acquire or do anything involving a rotation player at the trade deadline?
15%.
Yeah, I mean, so we're not counting like the inevitable Steve Novak tax dump.
No.
You know, we're talking about actually like really doing something that'll change the team this year.
Kevin Pelton has been high on their possibility of getting Joe Johnson. I guess with that would count. So maybe I'll bump it up to 40% with that, but 15% otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right, just because they're out those two first round picks in the future that they're going to be loath to deal any more of those. And also, they just have all these guys. I don't think they have anybody in their rotation they could trade to really get something except for Steven Adams, and they really need him. So, yeah, I am anticipating it will be a relatively quiet deadline for them, even as you might have thought at the start of the year that this would be continued desperation mode with KD. I mean, I don't see a move out there that brings them into real contention with San Antonio or Golden State.
Yeah, I think they more have that upside play, and there isn't really much they can do. That they made those decisions earlier, which kind of took offers off the table. I'm not really sure what they would have gotten now. Let's say that they, you know, hadn't made one of those moves, but it would have been interesting at least.
The Clippers, 35-18, an excellent 13-5, considering the Blake Griffin injuries since we last checked in on them. They are projected for the fourth seed by both BPI and 538, either 54 or 53 wins. And they are actually given a 3% chance at the title per 538. What do you think of those odds?
Yeah, I mean, the Warriors could get hurt. It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, yeah, it's got to be. And really, I guess you could say they don't have any tougher of a path than the Thunder do. You know, they're just going to have to beat Golden State, and they're going to have to beat San Antonio, just be probably in reverse order. So it doesn't really matter that much if they don't get the third seed, other than that they might have a slightly easier matchup in the first round. But, you know, I think once, if Blake comes back and he's really can get it going, he's someone who turned it up so much in the playoffs last year, which everyone seems to have conveniently very forgotten that, by the way, that he was probably through the first five games, or at least the first four games of that Houston series, the MVP of the playoffs. And everyone's saying, oh, they don't need Blake. They can trade him. The offense runs better with Chris Paul and DeAndre Jordan, especially because you can play everybody more minutes and you don't have to stagger, or you can stagger guys. You don't have to play the all bench unit as much, theoretically, if Doc finally comes around to that even more this playoffs than he did last year. I think that they really need Blake, and that he, if he can get back to the level of last year's playoffs, that makes him at least dangerous for those top two seeds, you know, to the point where they might get to a sixth game or something like that. I still don't think they beat him, but, and also it's the chances of him, after he's been out for so long, getting back to that level, integrating with everybody else again, that could also seems less likely than in past years.
You also have the peril with what people talking about him being traded, of having a guy who is functionally untradeable for a long time, and then you drop them down. That almost guarantees that you're looking to move them or thinking about it at the nadir in their value. And with Blake, I think it's an unrepresentative low point. You just think about what, you know, kind of what's happened and how well they played without him and things like that. And they're not going to get better by moving him. And while I don't, you know, you can possibly get some future assets, and I think my philosophy is always you just listen and hope a team makes a mistake. I think he's the wrong guy for them to move.
Who is the guy for them to move?
Oh, I wrote about this. You know this. I don't want him to hate me more than he already does if he happened to have read my piece.
Well, I think the odds of that are about as low as the Clippers title chances.
Hey, if they have a group text like the Warriors do, it's possible.
Let's move on to the Memphis Grizzlies, projected at 45-37 by BPI, 98% chance or higher projected chance at the playoffs by both of these projection systems. They do not, however, know that Marc Gasol is out. And also, they have a really bad point differential compared to their record, which is 31-22 and a nice 12-5 since we last checked in on them. On the other hand, you can also argue that this team regularly outperforms its point differential. So maybe that is a reason to believe that they can continue playing better than you might think with Gasol being out. I mean, what do you think of that 98% chance for the playoffs now that Gasol is out?
Way too rosy. I mean, what are they without him? They're probably getting Brandon Wright back, which is nice for as long as he can play and stay healthy, so like a week. And they just don't have the depth of, not only depth of quality, but depth of like who's really going to be the straw that stirs the drink. And as we say with every other team, when you lose one of your best players, it also means that any subsequent injury to a key guy or a role player becomes that much more devastating. And they're an older team. They're a team that has a lot of guys that could potentially fit that bill. So I think that's too high because they only have 31 wins right now, which is, you know, a sizable amount. But if they're below 500 the rest of the way, I think that provides a buffer. I'm not saying it would be a high chance they miss the playoffs, but it would be higher than 1%.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought after the Gasol news that they'd be really right back in the mix with those other four teams that are fighting for the last four spots in the West. But now if you really think about it, I don't think that's the case. I think they have enough of a buffer. So, I mean, like, what kind of ball do you think they would play? You know, like, what is their winning percentage, just sort of their natural winning percentage without Gasol? You know, like, maybe, like, 45% or something like that? Like, does that seem right to you?
Yeah, 45 is where I was going to put it. At first, I thought 40, but I'm like, no, they have enough. They have enough guys, Conley and Randolph, and, you know, they have perimeter guys, even though we don't love them. They have requisite talent, and they play hard. So, yeah, 45 seems about right.
Yeah, they'll probably play small a little bit more. Their offense actually has been surprisingly really good lately, and they've kind of gotten away from that grit and grind style of defense that they once had, and they've, I think, really become a little bit more of an offensive team than a defensive team of late. And but really, since they're 9 games over 500, they would probably have to go something like 10-19 to fall. That would get them to 500, and that seems pretty unlikely. That's basically like 350 winning percentage, and
I think they'll be better than that. It would take a real kick.
Two of Utah, Houston, and Portland to get, you know, up to like the 45 win range or something. And then if those teams got to there, then maybe I'm starting to sweat a little bit if I'm Memphis. But I think they'll be okay. I think they still have, you know, at least an 80% chance, if not more, of making the playoffs.
Do you want to take a short break from this to react to a trade that has been reported?
Yeah, I do.
The Detroit, I'm excited because I think you know nothing about this. The Detroit Pistons reportedly traded Brandon Jennings and Ersan Ilyasova to the Orlando Magic for Tobias Harris.
Very interesting. So basically, Detroit is using $16 million in cap space this summer on Harris.
Right.
And they still should have room to make another
kind of mid-level.
And it also looks like they now are essentially going to be playing with combo forwards, two combo forwards next to Drummond, with Marcus Morris and Harris. Maybe you throw Anthony Tolliver in the mix a little bit if they want to go with a little bit more of a pure four. What do you think of that deal? I like it for the Pistons.
Oh, I like it for the Pistons. I absolutely hate it for the Magic because you're getting basically no value. Brandon Jennings is an expiring contract at a position where, you know, he of course has his issues with the Achilles, but at a position where you have, you know, other guys, he's obviously a nice depth piece. And Ersan Ilyasova has a non-guaranteed or lightly guaranteed contract for next year. He's older. That's basically giving the reins to Aaron Gordon. So if what you wanted to do was basically get out of Tobias Harris, it feels like you could have gotten assets instead of just getting functionally expiring or near expiring contracts.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Brandon Jennings, maybe he's someone who can re-sign. I think C.J. Watson, with his health issues, you're probably looking at him as pretty much a sunk cost at this point. They need more shooting at backup point guard. On days when Elfrid Payton just isn't being guarded, maybe Jennings can help. And you could say maybe we can re-sign Jennings at a discount because he's coming off the Achilles injury. Ilyasova has that non-guaranteed, about $8 million or so for next year. Gets him a little more shooting at the four, a little more rebounding, but he can't really play next to Aaron Gordon. I don't think, maybe he can, because that could enable them to have Ilyasova be a shooter, Gordon play a little bit more inside on offense, and then they can switch roles on defense. Gordon guards whoever the best wing scorer is for the other team, while Ilyasova guards a traditional four. I understand the thinking, I guess, but it just seems like a very low sell for Tobias Harris to not even get a pick or anything, which sources appear to indicate. Yeah, I mean, I definitely like that for Detroit because they just have no scoring at all. And to turn guys, you know, Harris is a guy who could certainly grow and even being a lower-end all-star. Getting that type of talent onto the team when you're not a free agent destination, using the cap space early, like you talked about this sort of a trade, I think that's a great trade.
Great trade for Detroit. Them. Ready to move on? I assume Dallas is next?
Yeah, wow, I'm so flummoxed by that, I can't even go back to this mundane, like, recitation of records and, like, catching up on teams. But, yeah, so where are they at? Are they 27 and 25 right now?
They're 29 and 26. 10 and 11 since the last time we did this, which is, of course, disappointing. BPI has them being a 500 team in the sixth seed, but, of course, that doesn't account for the Gasol injury. And I feel like they're in a nice place because they're well coached, and when they're healthy, they have decent enough talent. But I don't really have them a cut above everyone else.
No, I don't either. And they really just kind of lack force as a team. They don't have a ton of athleticism. It would be nice for them to see over the rest of this season if they can swing, if they're not just fighting tooth and nail for their playoff lives, what they have in Justin Anderson. I think that's going to be a big facet to their offseason, and know that, all right, we have that the third wing on the spot or not, or even just to showcase him for a potential trade over the summer could be pretty useful. But, yeah, I think that Dallas, they are given an 85.6% chance of the playoffs by eight. Does that seem too high to you? It seems a little high to me.
It's a little high, but I think I'd say on the aggregate they're probably in a slightly better spot. I don't know.
Yeah, they do have basically a three-game lead on Houston, so that helped. That banked three games when you're talking about just, you know, a 30-game sample. Now that's actually a lot bigger than it kind of seems like it is when you're in the heat of battle.
One team, like you, yeah. It's not like they have to finish, you know, top two of these four. If they finish, that's to get the eighth spot even, but the incentive now, with this being a more open field, the incentive of getting even to the, like, getting to the fifth spot is so huge because that at least gives you a better chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the reason why they've been able to overperform what's been a pedestrian point differential this season is their clutch performance.
Yeah, their clutch performance has been great. They've been number two in the league on the season, which is plus 23.8 per 100 possessions. But in a kind of a fascinating twist, their record does not reflect that point differential because they're 18 and 13 in those games, which is, you know, still good, but not as good as you would expect considering that differential.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where, especially when you're dealing with such a small sample size of minutes, that one or two amazing games, like they had one of those games against the Sixers when they were down and then just, you know, blew them off the floor in the last couple of minutes early on in the year. Like a couple games like that can really skew things a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
The Utah Jazz also projected for 41 and 41, 78.7% chance at the playoffs per BPI. A little bit lower for 538 though, which has them at 71%. That's probably about right to me. I think that they're a better team than Houston or Portland. I would actually even expect them to beat out Dallas since they have pretty similar records. Yeah, the Jazz are at 26 and 26 now. I think that they are going to play better than Dallas the rest of the way. I would not necessarily expect them to catch Dallas just because Dallas has that extra three games banked, and Utah also is going to have to play three more games than Dallas as well, which, you know, obviously the lack of rest is going to hurt them. They start off the break with that back-to-back-to-back to make up the snow game that they missed in Washington. So that could really get them started at a little bit of a deficit coming back in. But I really love the way that they're playing lately. I think that their defense is something that is better than really anything else that any of these five teams fighting for the last four spots in the West have going for them. And if they can keep that up, especially as Gobert continues to return to full health after that MCL injury, I really like them the best of these teams. And I will kind of be rooting for them to get the fifth seed because I really want to see that Clippers-Utah series.
So do I. I think that given the health things that we already know, which is a little bit of a cop-out for Memphis, I would say the Jazz are the fifth-best team in the West for the rest of the way, but the schedule can be a little bit challenging for them. And also, one thing I noted with them is they, of the teams that are legitimate playoff contenders, and I don't count Sacramento in that group, they have the worst clutch performance. And that isn't to say, of course, some of that was while they weren't at full strength, but it is something to consider that as games grind down and as games slow down, their lack of a real point guard is something that could hurt them in a few close games.
So you think that that's real, not just random variation?
I think it's mostly random variation, but there's a little bit there just because whenever I look at a team that has a little bit of an issue in terms of shot creation late, and they have those moments. They have guys like Hood and Hayward that I like, but they don't have somebody who I think can always get theirs. Like you think about the way that they beat or the way that they kind of forced overtime against the Mavericks was, in a lot of ways, it was luck. It was that the Mavericks didn't foul when they had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's true. They do have two guys who can create a little bit in Hood and Hayward. But, yeah, a point guard, they don't have anyone who's going to create. They have Gobert, who the way teams are defending them now is they put the center on Favors and then the power forward on Gobert. And Gobert is not a guy who can post up. Basically, if he's not a dunk, he's very challenged to make it. Even if it's just a layup inside, like he'll get bumped off of that shot a lot. And so that power forward is spending a bunch of time, especially because Rudy is not quite at his most athletic after that injury where he can really get up for alley-oops. They're just, other teams are putting their four man and just having him muck up the lane. I think late teams are more attuned to that. And then also teams are more likely to have two guys on the floor late who can handle Hood and Hayward okay one-on-one. I do think that since the Jazz played a slow pace, I don't know that the slow pace of crunch time really is what kills them. I don't see, despite what I said, I don't see any reason to believe that they would be, you know, particularly worse or better as a crunch time team than any other team.
That's fair. Since we're recording this before the deadline, I've become more enamored since we did our mock deadline podcast of the idea of them getting Drew Holiday, because I just feel like he would be a nice fit with what they're doing. And it's possible that the asking price could be a little bit lower. Do you kind of feel the same way or do you disagree with me?
You know, I think he would be a good fit as someone who will be an excellent stopgap for next year. While Exum, you don't know what you're going to get out of him, both due to his youth and due to the fact that he's coming off the injury. And then you could either, but also you have Exum, you still got Neto, you don't have to play Holiday that many minutes to the point where that stress reaction could flare up. He can shoot the ball well enough off the ball or run pick and roll pretty well on your second unit a little bit. So he's and he's a solid defensive player, big enough to switch in a lot of matchups. I do like the fit a fair amount. Now, why New Orleans would be trying to deal him, I'm not sure, because he, if you are going to deal him, you're going to get draft picks, prospects, and now that AD is a superstar, I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit more when we get to them, sort of like what the master plan should be for this team, because I'm at a little bit of a loss for it, frankly. But I do like the fit. I mean, what would you be willing to give up for him if you were Utah?
I would start it with either Alec Burks or a first-round pick. They also have those extra Warriors picks, which aren't great, but are still worth, you know.
Yeah, and they have an extra pick for the Thunder, too. I mean, yeah, they have the 2017 Warriors, and then they got the 2018 Lotto Protected from the Thunder, and then they have all their own picks, too. I mean, if I'm New Orleans, maybe, I think I would want more than simply just Utah's pick unprotected this year. Or if not protected, like, you know, top three protected or something, just in case they miss the playoffs and get bumped up. But I think I would want a little bit more than that when you consider the contract that Holiday's on and also what a chameleon he is due to his ability to both run pick and roll and shoot well enough to play off the ball. And not all point guards can do that.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see if Utah, one of the ways that they can filter through this is also that they could take on, let's say the New Orleans wasn't happy with, obviously I wouldn't take Oshik considering his long-term contract, but if New Orleans said, hey, we'd prefer it if you could take Alexei Ajinsa, I'd seriously consider that too.
Houston next, they are 27 and 28, 40 and 42 projected record by BPI with a 66% chance of making the playoffs, 538 sees them at about the same almost exactly. And I guess it's at the point now with these projection systems, especially because Houston's point differential is much worse even than you'd expect for a team that's a game under 500. I think their net rating is around like -2 or so. I think even if you say your prior was this team was going to be better than it is, we've now reached the point where you really have to just settle in and say that what they've done this season over, you know, 60% of the season or more, that's just what they are.
It's incredibly frustrating, but you're right, because they have more potential. They have potential to be more than that, but even when they've been close to full strength, they've been disappointing to me. The losses to Portland, I think, are probably the ones that really linger. And they're, you know, they have the potential to be better, and something that BPI and all that can't really consider is the possibility that they, you know, do something in the next couple of days, which I would say it's more likely that they lower their chances of making the playoffs than raise them, just because the only possibilities where they'd be a buyer just seem like unlikely trades.
Yeah, and they do keep their pick if they don't make the playoffs here. It just immediately turns into a second rounder. So that is some incentive. On the other hand, this is a team that's hoping to do something in free agency this year. I think their owner, in his very pointed comments about the firing of Kevin McHale, rare public comments from Leslie Alexander, has shown that there is definitely some pressure on this front office still, that they can't, I think that with, they are not deluding themselves about how bad they are this year, but at the same time, I don't know that they can make that proclamation and just take a step back with guys who aren't going to help them this year as easily. You know, when you're talking about moving Howard, that's something that comes into play. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it is possible that they take a little bit of a step back, but I don't think it's particularly likely. One reason I could think of that maybe there should be more optimism is that they're actually, you know, their offense is better this year than it was last year. And maybe you can say somehow they just figure it out on defense the way they did last year, or maybe Howard starts playing better. We talked about on our awards podcast that he was one of my most disappointing players because he hasn't been able to lift their defense, but maybe that'll turn around and they'll be able to do that. So I think I feel like defense is kind of something that's a little bit easier to improve in season than offense, especially if you have a team that has a history of having defended reasonably well, but I don't consider that particularly likely either, frankly.
And I would say the main reason to be optimistic is that they have the talent to be better than they are, which is a reason to be frustrated, but is also something to consider that you think about their ceiling is really high. They were the second best team in the West last year with pretty similar roster construction. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say they were the second best team in the West, actually. I'd say they're the fourth or fifth best team.
Either way. But I mean, that's still better than they are right now. So
yeah. And also Oklahoma City was like artificially removed from that, you know, and I guess that's kind of one way to think about this is, hey, they won 56 games a year ago. You know, they were the second seed, but really I think the Spurs were better than them. The Clippers to me were pretty clearly better than them. Maybe you even could have said that a healthy Memphis team was better than them. You could have said that a healthy Portland team before they had all their injuries was better than them. And then Oklahoma City was unhealthy too. So maybe you could say, hey, this team overachieved so much last year that maybe they really were always kind of more down in the lower rung of the West playoff picture. Maybe not a 500 team, but not a team that really should have been talked about as a championship contender and that everything just broke right for them, including vastly outperforming their point differential last year.
That's a really astute point that I wish I had thought of in October.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were going to be pretty good, too. I thought they were going to be, you know, at least win 50 games, that's for sure. I don't think there was a person on the planet who felt that. But I think just in hindsight, maybe that's a way that it should have been looked at a little bit more, especially since you had a lot of guys having career years. But, yeah, maybe they can get it together defensively. They still have Ariza, Beverly, and Howard. That could be the foundation of a good defense if all those guys are playing to their capacity. But a lot of them have maybe declined quite a bit. Let us get to the Portland Trailblazers, also projected at 41-41, 74% chance of making the playoffs per BPI. So actually a little bit higher than the Rockets and actually higher than the Jazz as well. I'm sorry, that's not BPI. That's 538. Do you buy that? Or who do you like the best out of the Blazers, Jazz, and Rockets going forward as far as making the playoffs? They basically all have identical records right now.
I like the Jazz pretty clearly above the other two. And between the Blazers and Rockets, I think that Portland has punched above their weight to get to where they are, whereas Houston has not. However, that as you've talked about and as Kevin Pelton's talked about before, you know, like at a certain point, you have to really say, well, how has the team played? And I mean, Portland's 12-5 in their last 17. So I would lean loosely towards Houston, but I would say their odds should be about the same.
Yeah, it's interesting noting that each of the top nine teams in the playoffs has a greater than 50% chance of making it per both of these projection systems. But greater than 50% chance doesn't mean, you know, that you're going to get in. But I mean, you've got, you know, 82 for the Mavs, 74, 71 for the Blazers and Jazz, and then the Rockets, you know, the rest of that adds up to 53%. Then you've got Kings and Nuggets with like 9% each or so. I think, though, the Blazers are a little ahead of schedule. They also have some incentive to try and keep their pick, which is owed to the Nuggets from the Aaron Aflalo trade last year and is lottery protected. So we could see, I don't see them as like, all right, we're going to really go for it here at the trade deadline. And you could also say just that they're overperforming so far, just on an individual basis, that they have a really hard schedule the rest of the way. And that's about it. I think one guy who kind of typifies the performance they've had is CJ McCollum. And the way that he is succeeding gives you some question, because he might be one of these players who just is that awesome at from mid-range and, you know, breaks the normal way of doing things because he just shoots so well from there and can be efficient. But he only shoots 48% at the rim. He actually shoots better from 10 to 16 feet and at the rim. And I still am thinking there could be not a huge regression, but a little bit of a regression in his jump shooting, and that's something that could really affect their offense, especially when Dame Lillard is out of the game.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a way to think about it. I also, since our mock deadline thing, I really want them to make the trade that KP made, but I really doubt that's going to happen, because Hassan Whiteside there would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and they still ultimately, I think, need a great rim protector, someone who can get the backs of CJ and Dame Lillard. Also, I've heard a few things like, oh, they should trade Dame. CJ is that good. CJ is nowhere near as good as Dame Lillard. Like, let's get that out of the way. Even if you're, I mean, I don't think either of them is any great shakes defensively. Maybe Lillard is a little bit worse, but Lillard can just get his shot off way more easily from three. He is a much better distributor than CJ is, much better at getting to the rim, way more athletic. They're just not in the same class of player to me. And I think the advanced metrics kind of show that. They are somewhat similar, and I think they play well together, and they have a foundation of a great offense together. But to say that Lillard could be replaced by CJ if they were to trade Lillard, that is just not the case at all for me.
One of the most important, if not the most important part of an offense, is to have somebody who can be kind of the engine. And Lillard is far better at that than McCollum is. And if you lose Lillard, you're going to have to replace him with somebody who can do a lot of that. Because I don't think CJ, as wonderful as he's played this year, really has that in him, at least right now, but probably not ever. And so, yeah, you could get somebody who's maybe more of a different type of point guard. But the point for me is, if you can get the offense you're getting out of those guys, you can make up for their deficiencies defensively at positions where you're normally having guys who are defensively capable. It's a lot easier to pick up defense at the big man spots than to pick up offense.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I think that they should try to make it work with those guys. I mean, maybe it'll get to the point where CJ goes back into a bench role and then kind of finishes games, but I do think that those two guys, when you've got both of them, unless you're just putting complete stiffs around them. So I like those guys together. I would not be trying to move either of them, frankly, unless you're moving CJ in a package for just, you know, a total superstar, which I don't know is going to be available.
A superstar with team control, which is an important thing to consider. Yeah,
that's a great point too. Sacramento Kings, 22-31. They had a 5-game win streak that really got them into 500, and then they just have absolutely cratered since then and are 8-11 overall in their last 19 since we checked in on them, and really pretty much out of the playoffs now, 9% via 538, 5%, I think, by BPI.
So the big question for me with them now is the protection on their pick. It's top 10 protected. They're right in that range. And what's different is I think all the teams that are below them, especially if New Orleans takes their foot off the gas pedal, which I expect, all the teams below them in the West, which is 5 teams, will stay below them. So it's basically just how the East sorts itself out, because the only terrible teams in the East are the Nets and the Sixers. The Bucks are a little bit variable.
Well, I don't know. Actually, the Kings and Nuggets are projected to have identical 35-47 records at the end of the year right now by 538, and same by BPI. So I think the Nuggets actually could pass them. It wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean,
and the Nuggets also can swap with the Knicks. So if it looks like the Knicks are going to be worse than the Nuggets, they don't have the incentive to really tank the way the Kings would either.
That's interesting. And also, they're a team that you could talk about that their early part of the season where they were worse was non-representative because they didn't have Jokic. Or no, they didn't have Nurkic. Sorry, they had Jokic. They didn't have Nurkic.
Well, yeah, and Moutier was playing really badly, then missed a bunch of time. Now he's playing a lot better as well.
Anyway, so, we should get back to the Kings.
Do we have to? Okay.
Yeah, we do. Something that I had noted with them a long time ago and is still really true, part of it is pace, is that they're allowing 3 3-point attempts per game more than any other team in the NBA, which, you know, that we've talked before about, and Seth's written about it too, about how that is like really the kind of one of the big things that you can do as a defense is trying to prevent teams from shooting threes. And what exacerbates that problem is that if any team in the top 10 of allowed attempts, they have the second worst shooting percentage. So teams are shooting a ton on them and making a pretty respectable amount.
Yeah, we ordinarily talk about how teams can control three-point attempts against more than three-point percentage. But in this case, I think the fact that they are giving up so many, that dovetails with the fact that they're giving up such a high percentage. They're playing at this really fast pace. Part of why they're playing at such a fast pace is because they're giving up three-pointers on fast breaks to other teams very early in the shot clock. Those are great looks. And you just imagine overall, if you're giving up a ton of three-point attempts, there's a reason teams are taking those shots, right? Because they're open. So I think in this case, maybe the fact that they're giving up a high percentage and a really high number of attempts is are related to one another more than it might be for your typical team.
Yeah, I agree with that. Two other little tidbits with them. Rajon Rondo has the worst points per possession in transition of anyone with more than 100 possessions at 0.67, which is a little bit concerning when you think about where this team is going long term. It could be a small sample size issue, but it's still concerning.
Yeah, and there's a very easy reason for that, right? Like, he assist hunts all the time, so that doesn't show up in that, right? It's all points, those synergy numbers, it's just either shot attempts or it's turnovers. And so his shot attempts, he doesn't shoot a good percentage at the rim necessarily, and he's passing up a ton of shots, so he's trying to pass it, and then he's turning it over a bunch of those times. So that's why that number is so low. And then also Cousins is also has the worst of a category in ISO points per possession.
Yeah, he is the worst ISO points per possession of anybody with more than 100 at an eye-popping 0.58 points per possession. So that means he gets he gets a basket every 4 times, right?
Basically, yeah, and a couple of reasons for that too. He is another guy who's pretty turnover prone. And remember that synergy delineates between post-ups and isolations. It's kind of a gray line between those. How close to the basket does a post-up start or an isolation end? But for him, he does quite fine on regular post-ups when he actually works hard, gets position, and then moves in and gets fouled. Whereas I think a lot of these ISOs, it's just jumpers that he's pulling up. It's trying to create off the dribble and turning it over just when he's not catching the ball as close to the hoop as he should. And there's been talk that he isn't in the greatest shape. When he really fights hard for position and nobody can really stay in front of him, or if he gets to the point where the other team fronts him, Rondo is great at throwing those lob passes to him as well. It really shows how important it is for him to catch the ball closer to the basket instead of just, oh, I'm going to put my hand out, throw it to me, and now I'm going to go to work 25 feet from the basket, 20 feet from the basket.
And doesn't that sound similar to the guy who's next lowest in ISO PPP, Jahlil Okafor?
Yeah, it does a little bit. I actually think Okafor is a little bit better facing the basket than Cousins is at this point. But all right, who do we have next? The aforementioned Denver Nuggets, huh?
Yeah, the Denver Nuggets, who, as you said, they have an identical, it's 538, I believe, that has them identical at 35 and 47 projection. But the Nuggets, kind of remarkably, so they're 22 and 32. They're 10 and 9 since the last time we did this. And they're just a feisty, competitive team. I really like watching them.
Yeah, they've gotten better play out of the Youngs. You mentioned Jokic, who has been fantastic. I mean, he's in like the top 20 in the whole league in PR at this point. And not unbelievable on defense, but he hasn't been so bad that Mike Malone hasn't been playing him. So that's been fantastic. Gallo is having a great year. As you noted, he is number one in transition points per possession at 1.58. That is nearly triple DeMarcus Cousins' isolation points per possession. And yeah, just this is a real fun team to watch. Will Barton has been a revelation. And I think that they are one of these teams that is going to close strongly, and because they have the swap with the Knicks, they're not going to be trying to tank either down the end, and these young guys are just getting better anyway, even if they're going to play them. So I think they're going to have a pretty strong close of the year, although the 9% chance of them making the playoffs seems like too high to me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's closer to BPI's maybe 3.8%, just because, you know, there's always a chance that two of these teams fall out. But Denver, the other thing, I don't have numbers on this because I haven't gone through it all the way yet, but Moutier, after he came back from injury, like, his shooting percentages are at a respectable level. They're not good yet, but they're respectable. And it's like, if you can think about it as a teenage point guard, if that is his real baseline, not what happened beforehand, and I'm not saying it is, of course, you're dealing with small samples in both ways, but that is a much better place to start from than where he was before, as like one of the worst players in a lot of different ways that the league has seen recently.
One thing to watch over the second half of the year is Yusuf Nurkic's performance. I noted just in watching him that he looked to have a lot less explosion this year coming off of that partially torn patellar tendon that it took him quite a while to get back from. He's been awful so far. He has a 4.11 true shooting percentage and 13.5 PR. He's at least still getting on the offensive glass for 13% of the Nuggets' misses and on the defensive glass, but really other, and he also has a 28% usage. So he basically has turned into Moutier from the first half of the year, where he has just a miserable true shooting and he's shooting the ball all the time. He has rightfully been supplanted by Jokic in the starting lineup, and maybe that'll never go back, would be surprising for, Nurkic certainly has a lot better physical tools than Jokic and maybe can be a better defensive player, can be. That is definitely a concern that he has looked so bad coming back from injury, and for a guy who was supposed to be a huge part of this team's future, I hope that that injury is not something that really could be career altering, but he is definitely not back yet, we'll put it that way.
It isn't a direct example of this, but it is another reason why you take the best player available instead of being like, oh, we have somebody at this position, because you never really know what could happen.
New Orleans is 20 and 33, 9 and 11 since we last checked in on them, at which point we said, hey, they got to start playing at least the way they played last year to start moving towards the playoffs. That has not, in fact, happened. They are really essentially out of it. They would need to go 21-8 over their last 29 games to reach 500. I think that is just about impossible. And so it is about time for them to pack it in this year, get a better draft pick, maybe trade guys like Ryan Anderson, who it was reported is very intent on at least testing free agency. That also is not something that you want to hear if you're New Orleans, even if you're trying to trade him, because now you're going to get back less for him if he is really intent on trying to play the market. And, you know, $20 million a year or so has been bandied about for him. That's too much for New Orleans to pay, I think, with where they're at. But The bigger thing I wanted to talk to you about, I mean, this is a team that's projected to be 34 and 48 this year by both of the projection system, is what would you do right now? Assume, you know, you don't have any of these ownership pressures or anything. You're just taking over fresh as a GM. You want to just set this franchise up the best it can be for the future. What is like your overall strategy?
There isn't a lot you can do in the short term. I think you have to, as I was their GM in the mock thing, is you want to weigh the offers that you get, both in terms of future assets, present assets, and then also the possibility of dumping Omar Asik's contract. And I'm assuming it'll be something with future assets that is the best offer, just because that's the way it usually works. But outside of that, you can't trade Tyreek Evans. Nobody's going to take him right now. You don't really have young guys that you can sit there and go, oh, we hope we're going to do that. So one thing I would lean at with them, this is what I wrote in the Brooklyn Nets piece, a team that kind of is strangely hopeless in a similar way in the near term, which is cycle through 10-day contracts, rest of the year contracts, and try to get the next Tyler Johnson. And if you can get that, that's something really positive that can come from this season. And he's an anomaly. You're not going to probably get somebody that good, but if you can get even a lowest rotation player, the 9th or 10th best guy on your team, just by trying out guys this year, that would be a wonderful success.
Would you consider just dumping everything on the roster that's not tied down except for Anthony Davis at this point?
I consider it, but at the same time, Drew Holiday, unless you got a nice offer, like I think what we were talking about with Utah is about what I would consider. I would consider keeping him just because I think that allows you to evaluate what you have more. It's a criticism I've levied at the Sixers a couple of times, is like, if you don't have a point guard, you don't have somebody who can run your offense, you can't really see what else you have. But other than that, sure. I mean, I don't see, you know, one of the things I like to do when I think about a team is, you know, what is their core? And then you have kind of an inner core, and for some teams you have an outer core. And with them, it's just Davis. There isn't anybody else there that you're sitting there going, oh, they have to be a part of this team.
Yeah, that's really right. Maybe you could say it's Drew, that if he comes back and plays again next year, he's a guy who would have a low cap hold and might be able to squeeze out an extra $5 million in space over what he would get on the open market versus what his cap hold is in 2017. But if I could get two first rounders for him, I might. I think what I would try to do is really, if there were a way, and maybe there isn't, you know, it might be that they have so much bad salary on the books now that it just, you wouldn't be able to get both picks and dump all your bad contracts. But if I could dump Asik, trade away Anderson, trade away Eric Gordon, maybe even Quincy Pondexter, or maybe he was only making $3 million, so maybe you keep him around and hope that he can come back and at least be a rotation guy. Dante Cunningham, might try and move him as well. He's making $3 million or so next year, and then has a player option the year after that. But really, what I would try and do is get some picks, and then also be as bad as you can and get as good of a pick as you can this year, and just hope that that guy can be the second star around Davis. Davis is going to be 23 now, basically. So, you know, if you're going to try to reboot, you want to do it maybe for like 2 years from now. But the thing is, if you get those picks, it's not like, okay, we're going to use this pick and then he's only going to be good 3 years from then, and that's not going to be on AD's timeline. You could also just flip those picks later to try to get some rotation guys who are on okay contracts, you know, around this time next year. And then also, maybe even if you draft someone who's really good, you could flip him for, you know, to be good around the same time that AD is starting to get better. But I do think that really holding on to the ghost of this team, Gordon, Anderson, those guys are probably going to get overpaid. You might as well get rid of them anyway. I don't think that's the way to go. I think it is in need of just about as much of a teardown as you can manage. And then, you know, this summer you may have to overpay for guys, but then you could try and get guys on those 1-2 year deals that I talked about and just try to be respectable around AD, get back to like at least being a lower rung playoff team next year and maintain flexibility as time goes on. I mean, now that's not a perfect solution. That's not what Tom Benson's going to want to hear, certainly, when this team finally made the playoffs last year. It's not what Dell Demps, who is an embattled GM perpetually, is going to want to hear either. But I think that's all that you can do, because otherwise you're just, where are you going to find more above average players beside Anthony Davis unless you kind of tear it down a little bit and deal with some more pain? The sad part is, if they could have just dealt with this pain the first couple of years that AD was on the roster, then they could have actually been getting to be good right now instead of kind of tearing things down a little bit.
That's why you never rush a rebuild. And since we're already in a dark place, I'll mention that this possibility was a big part of what I was thinking about when I wrote the piece about Anthony Davis potentially taking the qualifying offer, is the reality of looking at, you know, being a really good but kind of sadly irrelevant player, and there's a possibility that he's that for a couple more years, and that's always hard to take, and I think Davis is, you know, he's too good for that, but that might be the way that it happens.
Yeah, it's really a shame to see kind of what's happened, and even just that he personally has kind of regressed this year as well. And while I think we all thought that Alvin Gentry might be the guy to take this team to the next level, and he has had some injuries, he also, I think, has not done a fantastic job. He's played way too many guys together at the same time who can't score. Their five best guys, granted due to injury, but still, even when they're available, barely played with one another. And we'll see. I mean, I presume he sticks around for another year, but then a bad start to next year. And you have to imagine, like, he would really be on the hot seat again as well.
Yeah. Minnesota?
Minnesota is next, projected at 27-55, based off their current 17-37 record, 5-14 since we last checked in on them. They have about a 31% chance of getting a top three pick if they finish where they are now at 13th in the West.
They will not win 10 more games. Straight up, they will not win 10 more games.
And are you saying that just because they're going to tank?
I'm saying that because they're not going to win 10 more. They're not good enough to win 10 more games.
I don't know. I mean, what about like this new starting lineup that they've trotted out that's actually been kind of successful these last couple of games?
Yeah, it is. I just see when I watch them, you just see a team that's going to be kind of like what I thought Orlando was going to be, which is a team that's good enough to be competitive, but not good enough to win games against teams that are non-terrible. What could be a factor with that is if other teams really tear it down, like let's say New Orleans tears it down like we were just talking about, then I think this is a Minnesota team that could beat franchises like that. Phoenix, you know, like I think they and you know, they had that surprising win against the Raptors recently, but I just when I watch them, I don't get that feel. However, Karl Anthony Towns is fantastic, and of course he and Wiggins and Rubio and all those guys, when they're playing well, They do have the upside to beat those teams. When I watch them, I don't see a team that's going to win 10 more games. It's subjective. I admit that.
Yeah, I think it seems like kind of about right. I mean, winning a third of their remaining games, that's basically right about the pace that they're on right now. I'm not sure how bad their schedule is either. But, and also just Karl Towns is getting better. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that's part of it. Wiggins also has been playing a little bit better of late. What do you make of these periodic Rubio trade talks? Would you be trying to move him if you were the Wolves?
No. So Rubio isn't the perfect end game for them, especially if Wiggins, let's say, lack of shooting is something that is, like catch and shoot particularly, is something that will be more consistent. But he's a player that is incredibly good at a position that is very valuable, and that if you move him for almost anything else, you're going to get something that's inferior. It's not like you're going to get a top 15, or like you're not going to get a really high end point guard for him. And there are none of those guys in the draft. So it's not like they're sitting there going, oh, well, we're going to get a top three pick. That's going to get us Chris Dunn, who is not going to be bad, but isn't really going to be in that space. So I never say never, because there are certainly somebody could make a mistake and make too big an offer. But almost every offer that I could think of as a realistic possibility for Ricky Rubio would be a mistake for the Wolves to make.
Rubio, always there's been a disconnect between what his traditional stats have shown: bad field goal percentage, doesn't score a ton, you know, good assist guy, good steal guy, but his on-off metrics have always been very, very positive. He's under contract for an average of about $14 million over the next 3 years. And I think that is a long enough time period where you can say, and he's right in his prime right now, that is a long enough time period where you can say, keeping him around as the point guard with someone like Towns, who can shoot the ball pretty well. Wiggins, as you said, not a great fit if he's not going to keep shooting. There actually were some somewhat disturbing reports in an article by Kevin Ding of Bleacher Report saying that Wiggins hasn't really been working that hard. He misses weightlifting sessions compared to like Towns, who has been an unbelievable worker and teammate so far. So that's a little concerning with Wiggins as someone who really needs desperately some skill development to go with his, and some more strength as well to go with his obvious natural athleticism. But yeah, I mean, what are you going to get for Rubio? Are you going to get a draft pick? They have a million draft picks already. They're going to have another really high pick this year. I mean, maybe if you could get a long-term starting power forward, who can shoot the ball, I might think about it and is a pretty decent defensive player, but I don't know that Rubio even gets you that guy. And maybe he's under contract for long enough that maybe if Tyus Jones starts to develop, you could trade Rubio around the deadline next year if you're really happy with what Jones is giving you. But I don't see any reason to move him now. And I don't think that there are really any suitors out there for him either.
Right. And even though they have a lot of other kind of needs, because Towns is, as we think about him, as a straight five, and Wiggins is a little bit nebulous in terms of his positioning because he can defend a couple different guys, you're going to have to find a team that wants Rubio and has the right kind of assets. And I don't really know what that is. I thought about kind of the idea of Mirotić, but I don't think that's the right type of trade, and I don't think the Bulls really consider that either. But yeah, it's hard to find something that works. Rubio's a guy who also, it's hard for me when I think I like somebody better than the aggregate. I always feel uncomfortable thinking about trades with them because I always feel like I'm going to be disappointed.
The Phoenix Suns, 14 and 40. They are projected at 24 and 58 by BPI. That is way too good as far as I'm concerned. I do not see them winning another 10 games. If you want to talk about a team that's not going to win another 10 games.
Yeah, it's much more fair to say that with them, of course. They're a lot more desperate and hopeless and all that kind of stuff. And so my
desperate and hopeless and all that kind of stuff.
Do you disagree with that?
It's just like one of my favorite little phrasings that I think you've had. You sort of were like rambling on, like not even thinking about what you were saying. And I was like, yes, like that's what they are. They are desperate. And they are hopeless and all that kind of stuff.
Even when I'm rambling,
you described it perfectly.
So yeah. In 10 games, 24 minutes of crunch time since Eric Bledsoe's injury, the Phoenix Suns have been outscored by 55.1 points per 100 possession, allowing 149.3 points per 100 possession. They did win two of those 10 games, but still.
Yeah, that is the statistical manifestation of desperate and hopeless and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and they really have, when you don't have a point guard, that's probably a reason why you might expect for that to be the case. And you don't really have a guy who is a great shot creator. Booker and Archie Goodwin are doing the best they can, but they don't really have the experience. Knight's been out, Bledsoe's out for the year. Even Ronnie Price is out. It's really been pretty remarkable. They're 2-15 in their last 17, and I think that they're just going to continue playing at that pace essentially for the rest of the year.
They're terrible.
And in fairness, BPI doesn't know that Bledsoe is out for the year. 538 has him at 22-60. I think they might even be worse than that. I think that they are probably my favorite to be the third worst team in the league now, and that would be behind another of our favorites, the Los Angeles Lakers.
Also, sorry, Boston. I agree with you. I think the Nets will be better the rest of this year.
Yeah, the Lakers actually have, let's give you some stats on the 11-44 Lakers, 3-17 in their last 20. They are projected by both the projection systems at 18-64, which would be the second worst record in the league, 55.3% chance of keeping that top three protected pick. Here are a few numbers on how you get to 11-44. Their overall net rating is 0.7 points per 100 worse now than the 76ers. They have a negative 22.2 net rating in the first quarter. And the Warriors have a 23.7 net rating in the first quarter. So basically, in the first quarter, this team is as bad as the Warriors are good, which is pretty remarkable. And this is a team that also, under Byron Scott's somewhat antiquated approach, runs a ton of post-ups and is terrible at them.
They are terrible at them. Julius Randle has the second lowest points per possession on post-ups for any player with more than 50 possessions, actually behind or ahead of, quote-unquote, you know, second to Draymond Green, which is a little bit surprising, but that's not the strength of Draymond's game. And Roy Hibbert is third, and he's the worst with more than 100 points per possession, and those two aren't even the only two bad post-up players who get a lot of them on that team.
Yeah. Kobe is also really bad at post-ups and just, you know, something that they run a lot of, and, you know, I guess if they keep that top three protected pick, all of this angst and all of this excoriation that we've been giving their product on the floor these last 2 years will have been worth it to not lose that pick 2 years in a row and get two top three picks as a result. Well worth all of this pain, because this team wasn't going anywhere the last 2 years anyway.
Yep, once Kobe signed his extension, that was pretty much where this was going to go.
Yeah, and once they hired Byron Scott as the coach, too.
Well, that too.
All right. Anything to plug before we go?
You know me. I always have stuff to plug. I wrote a thing on the dunk contest and kind of little tweaks for that for the Sporting News. Warriors Weekly came out today. And also, I wrote a piece that'll come out tomorrow on Wednesday, but I think people will enjoy, where I went through all 30 remaining Warriors games and ranked them intuitively from hardest to easiest. And so it's kind of a way to think about, as they're approaching history, where different games fall on that kind of continuum.
All right. You can follow Danny on Twitter at Danny LaRue. Follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. Also, this is useful. We talked about this during free agency. I have a Twitter list that I compiled of NBA newsbreakers. So if you're trying to just follow the trade deadline on Twitter, that's a good way to ensure. I think I've got everyone major on there. And if they're not on there, they will retweet someone who does have news. So basically, it's only 16 people. It's not too many tweets. You can keep up with them all during a day. So I definitely recommend subscribing to that list that I have on Twitter, and that's Nate Duncan NBA. Also, as we get ready for the trade deadline, if you haven't yet listened to our mock trade deadline podcast, and we also did over the last couple of weeks trade deadline previews for all of the divisions. So that should keep you going, and we'll be back with some content breaking apart these trades, including this Tobias Harris. We'll have much more on that and anything else that goes down. Till then.